Okay. We'll go around and say nay, starting with Domio.
Domio.
Bob.
Bob.
Yeodu.
Yeodu.
Joan.
Joan.
Jill.
Jill.
Ruthann.
Ruthann.
Susan.
Susan.
Tiffany.
Tiffany.
Drew.
Drew.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Paul.
Paul.
Kathy.
Kathy.
Zach.
Zach.
Yeshe.
Yeshe.
Mark.
Mark.
Jeff.
Jeff.
Richard.
Richard. Sam.
Oh, yeah. So, announcements next Sunday, that's the 9th of June. We are going to have a guest speaker. Her name is Diane, what is it, Salton Briggs?
Cajun Salton Briggs?
Yeah. You want to say something about her, don't you?
Yeah. So she is a longtime Zen practitioner, master of the Japanese formal tea ceremony. It's my teacher. I studied that for a couple of years, and she was my teacher. And I don't know, she's just a really captivating person who just totally embodies the phrase, every day is a good day. Which means it's kind of even more poignant that she's going to be talking about, in part, about her recent book, which is a memoir of sorts of her husband, his decline and dying of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of his gradual loss of words, and I don't know, just in how she dealt with that through her practice and through haiku and tea and whatever. So I highly recommend coming to meet her.
And that's at 11 o'clock?
11:15 to 12:15.
And then June 15th at 10 o'clock is the poetry group, and June 22nd the book group. And July 13th is our usual potluck, which we have every second month, once in 2 months. And this time I'm having it at my house. My husband and son built a brand new deck, so I'm going to show that off. So it's going to be dinner, because there's Awakening to Whiteness here. They meet at 3?
3 to 5.
So it's going to be hard to do it in the morning, so we're going to do it in the evening. So family, friends, all welcome. Should be a nice summer evening, so bring picnic blankets or whatever, and you can all sit around and talk about the Dharma.
Or not, as you choose.
Well, everything is the Dharma. Because a friend of mine would say, well, when we grab a Buddhist book or a listen to a talk, we think it's okay because we are grabbing a Buddhist thing, right? It's only when we do it non-Buddhist, oh, we shouldn't do that. But grabbing it, instead of practicing.
Yeshua, what was the date for that?
What? July 13th.
July 13th. 13th.
July 13th.
That's my birthday, so I guess you're just throwing a birthday party.
And bring your children. Will you cake?
And,
yeah.
Is that a
Saturday?
Yes. So we'll do it at 6 o'clock, Domio, what do you think?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Zach, you brought your kids once, didn't you? To her house?
Yeah.
Yeah, for the Christmas party.
Did they have fun?
Yeah.
Even though they were only, even though they were only kids?
Yeah.
They were well behaved.
They were?
Because they kept asking me, can we go there? Can we do this? You know?
They did?
Yeah. Oh, you don't?
I thought they were being in terrors.
Tell a story about what you said to Domio's husband.
Oh, Domio's husband, my kids were fighting, and he said to my son, you know, when I was your age, I always wanted a little sister. And he looked at him and said, maybe you should put it on your list.
It was Christmas time. It was Christmas time. Oh, that's so funny.
They have fun with
He finds it really stressful and exhausting to be really friendly and social with adults, but kids, he's all over kids.
Oh, cool. Loves kids. So I have one thing. This book, some of you may or may not have noticed, keep it out there on the desk. The purpose of it is to jot down, we're trying to track stuff that people bring in to as an in-kind donation, whether it's cookies or tea or whatever that you bring in, that you buy for the send over. So we're really trying to keep track of how much is being spent, even though we're not always asking for reimbursement. If you ask for reimbursement, that's fine, but either way, we just like to track how much it costs to stuff.
Yeah, because I mean, sometimes somebody will be doing a particular job, like being head of the cleaners, and just miraculously cleaning supplies just show up, and you know, and then if that person moves out of that position, we'll just be like, where do cleaning supplies come from?
Yeah, toilet paper, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh, all that stuff. Thank you.
Okay. Tonight, continuing with this book, Zen Teachings in Challenging Times.
Daniels?
Yeah. Oh.
She reminded me that I didn't say anything about the retreat. Do you want to say something about
it? Oh, we have 21 people signed up so far.
Wow, that's great.
Which, not quite, no. We're 21 at the peak. And but most people are there for the whole time. And you know, we can easily accommodate 25 to 30, so if you're still thinking about it, go ahead and sign up. Registration's on the front page of the website. And the deadline for sign up is really only like, let's say, maybe 2 weeks before. This is August 20 through the 25th. I mean, it's nice to know sooner so we can be making our plans and stuff, but you know, if it turns out that, you know, you really can't commit until the kind of the last minute, you know, still welcome. And also welcome to arrive Tuesday night, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. But it is a little bit of a drive out there. It's like an hour and 15 minutes out to the camp that's near Yamhill.
I just wanted to mention on the website, it says it starts on Thursday. It says Thursday, but it has the right dates.
Huh, okay.
That was a little confusing.
Yeah. There's always a million details. I'll check it out. So tonight's chapter, I'm going to be doing a little bit of reading because this is a cool chapter. But this is called Taking Refuge in Sangha. How wide can this Buddha field be? And it's by Hobu Beata Chapman. And she is, let's see, she was ordained by Sobun Catherine Tanis Roshi and received Dharma transmission from Meiji Tony Patchell after studying intensively with Darlene Cohen. And she leads a Zen community in California. And she's somebody who, let's see, in the teaching of tradition of Darlene Cohen, offers meditation groups for people living with chronic pain and illness. All right, so she starts with the three refuges. I take refuge in Buddha before all beings, immersing body and mind deeply in the way. I take refuge in Dharma before all beings, entering deeply the merciful ocean of Buddha's way. I take refuge in Sangha before all beings, bringing harmony to everyone, free from hindrance. So refuge It's sanctuary, protection, shelter, safety. Refuge means all of these, and it would come to prove itself as my life began to transform in following the Buddha's way. Transformation is a mystery. PTSD is a mystery. Neurological, yes. Psychodynamic, yes. Relational, yes. Spiritual, definitely. About one's place in the universe, one's worthiness to be alive, one's right to have needs, to take up space, to belong. Love escapes. Powerful grief, rage, hate. Things very unacceptable in this world, maybe even more so in Zen. From the beginning of practice, I've been very struck by the 10th grave precept, do not be angry. Frankly, it made me mad. It seemed to run counter to what therapists were telling me, to let myself be angry. How could religion tell me how to feel? I feel what I feel. I can't just not be angry. This conundrum would take many years to reconcile. Although I'd love to be able to offer deep wisdom, full of helpful guidance for practice in difficult times, I can only tell my own story. In so doing, I try to paint a picture of how Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha transformed this heart-mind through excruciatingly difficult times and gave me the ability to feel loved, to stay in with my own life, and to experience real joy. Through years of practice, the realization that staying with my own life brings the experience of real joy has become an essential touchstone. Years and years of being seen and known in the Sangha brought the ability to feel undeniable love. After all, I can't say they don't know me because they do, intimately. Nothing is hidden in Sangha. My hope is that others may be able to glean something useful from my story of practice transformation.
Just a question, is she in a monastic sangha?
I think she's kind of like San Francisco Zen Center lineage, ordained. I don't know that she ever did a long stint in a residential community, but she might have. From the very beginning of my exposure to Zen practice, specifically service, I was in trouble. Extreme PTSD, hard earned through 18 years of extreme sexual, physical, emotional, and spiritual neglect and abuse, had left my body-mind hardwired for unwelcome defensiveness and self-protective reactions. In truth, by the time I was 17 years old, I had been tortured, held captive, publicly humiliated, starved, beaten, kicked, and entirely abandoned. I had been sexually abused as a small child for years on end by a man I can only describe as a sadist. To escape from him, I moved to northern Idaho and entered what it would take years to learn was a religious cult. I was lucky I made it through that time, although each and every day I wished I would die. To tell the complete truth, I believed I was stupid for surviving, because the personal and relational costs of living with the effects of my early life were a hell realm of their own, seemingly eternal. Victor Sogen Hori's comment on Tozan's Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi: unaware it was a jewel, he thought it just rubble, describes well my view of myself, Beata Chapman. At that time, such self-loathing being a deep core issue in persons with developmental chronic PTSD. The secrets I held about the truth I was living were changing my body and mind, having their way with my neurology and building foundational tracks that would be with me for the rest of my life. Or, as Uchiyama Roshi might say, for this period in the life of the self. 35 years of therapy would eventually convince me that I had done all I could, and the scars left in me were well earned. I came to know that there would always be a residue of PTSD in this mind and body. And yes, that meant I would sometimes suffer, and those around me would sometimes suffer. And so it is with all of us in our total interdependence. The fact that we cause suffering for one another, seemingly without wanting to do so, is part of the mundane anguish of all our lives. When I came to Yokoji Zen Mountain Center in 1991 and first experienced Zen practice, I was completely taken aback by my reaction to what I experienced. The priests and monks came into the Buddha Hall for Zazen and service, all dressed in black robes, and everyone was so serious, looking down and not talking. Wow. That threw me right back to the religious cult, and I bolted out of the Zendo and down at a table outside. Roshi, a young priest at the time, followed me. So I think this must have been, I don't know which Roshi, who she's talking about. One of her teachers? Maybe it was Catherine Thanis? I don't know. But somebody who ends up being one of her teachers. A young priest at the time followed me. She patiently listened to me cry and say that they were all from the devil and that obviously I had misunderstood. "Who are you bowing to?" I wailed. And she smiled calmly. The woman was unflappable. There was a pause when I tried to recover a little dignity. Roshi sat forward, and I thought she was going to say something like, "Can I help you pack up?" But what she says was, "What would it take for you to be here with us?" My heart blew open. So vast was she, I wanted to be like that. She could include even me. Without a doubt, it was the most shockingly wonderful and terrifying thing anyone had ever said to me. She didn't even pause, as if no other thought crossed her mind except to include me. That's how vast she was. Apparently, to be like her, I would have to learn to sit still and do Zazen. There was nothing merciful in that Zazen, I knew for sure, but it was a small price to pay for that vast, that open, that able to include whatever comes. Roshi's vastness blew my mind in every sense of the word and changed my life forever. Zen practice became an indelible and undeniable part of my life through thick and thin from then on. The Yokoji Sangha made wide space for me and met me right where I was in my high anxiety, panic, and fear. When I ran out of the room sweating because my body could not remain, Roshi followed slowly and patiently. Maybe I was her assignment. I'll never know, because they were so big-hearted, so genuine, and so present, that it all seemed quite ordinary to them. As time went on, I asked another priest to be my teacher, and she agreed. That, too, took me by surprise. How fortunate was I? She made the field wider and wider as I showed up in various ways. Undaunted, she made ways for me to be a respected part of the Sangha and also to practice Zazen and study no matter what was presented. One time I was very restless, and she suggested that I get an all-white cushion to paint during our upcoming session. That cushion saved my life. I painted the outer rim like a rocket taking off with fire and smoke. It allowed my body mind to know that I could always rocket out of there. And in so doing, it allowed me to feel more confident and stay longer. Perhaps it gave me permission to leave. In some way internally, it overcame parts of the deep injuries of having been held captive and tortured as an adolescent. Little by little, with just a teaspoon moving the mountain of snow, incomprehensible, wrenching confusion and pain, teacher and Sangha right alongside me, refuge in Buddha, refuge in Dharma, refuge in Sangha right there, living and breathing. So then she describes how, then she ended up having physical issues, a back injury and nerve pain, and basically sitting on the floor or sitting on a bench is just, and even in a chair is just pretty much intolerable. But she did not want to do reclining meditation, even though I think it was probably Darlene Cohen. Probably Darlene Cohen she's talking about when she says Roshi. I don't know. It's weird. Because Darlene Cohen, she also wrote a book, Turning Suffering Inside Out, and she's somebody who practiced with, I think she had RA, she had just, you know, immense pain throughout most of her adult life, and found a way to practice, you know, with it, despite it, and she had various reclining postures that she would have people do, and they would still feel like meditation. So she describes how she had resisted doing lying down meditation, just, you know, that was a cop-out, that wasn't real, something like that. But then somebody asked her to be Shuso at Santa Cruz Zen Center, and they said, you know, they suggested she attend a workshop, a day of practice for people who don't think they can practice because of pain. And maybe that's what she meant to Darlene Cohen, because I not only met my next teacher for the first time, but also wept at learning how to lie down for Zazen in a real posture that included all the elements of upright posture. There was no compromise. I was happy to be able to embody the ritual enactment of Zazen in a way that worked for my body, that all I wanted to do was sit Zazen, lying down. Selena Shuso at her sangha, they just put out two cushions instead of one so that she could lay down. So, in closing, so her mother had been involved in that cult that she mentioned. Unlike my mother before me, I am surrounded by bounty and actually feel bountiful. I can feel loved. I can arrive, albeit roughly, and even stay. Zen has taught me to hold lightly and allow to include and wrap into myself whatever arises, as we are not to. Anger, yes, that too. Hate, yes. Joy, yes. Love, yes. Compassion, empathy, caring, yes, those too. I often practice with the question, what am I excluding from me right now? And I open, open, open. This capacity gives me great joy. The farther I push myself, the greater the joy. For the most part, my contribution to this transformation was simply coming back again and again and leaving again and again until the fundamental teaching nested within me. It took over 18 years. We are all, each and every one of us, not separate from our experience in any way. We are entirely interdependent and reliant on the common good. At the same time, the words of Sawaki Roshi, the homeless monk, cannot be better stated. You cannot share even so much as a fart with another person. We are not one. Each of us must find their own way. As my late teacher Darlene Cohen said, moment after moment, we have to find our own way. Each of us must make our own way. And when we do, that way will express the universal way. So I have a couple study questions, but just open it up if anybody has a comment or thought right off the bat.
I'm just curious as to how she could have fulfilled Shuso role lying down. How could she observe people?
Well, I guess, you know, she wasn't looking at him at that moment. But, you know, there's a lot of other stuff to it.
Yes.
I guess she'd keep an eye on him when they were doing kinhin or something like that.
What struck me is that it wasn't like she had any amazing awakening experience while she was sitting and that transformed her life. It's just someone asking her, what will it take for you to be part of this community? That opened her up. I mean, that seems to me, I mean, there's so many different ways you can dharma gates, you know? I mean, it worked for her, may not have worked for me. You know, it's just a simple thing, kept her practicing, not like any fun, like amazing opening or anything like that. It's really sweet and simple.
Well, each
it seems to me that somebody asking, with her experience, somebody asking that question would not be a little thing. Mm. I mean, that would be like, well, as I said, lower mind. Somebody wanted me to be here. I mean, that's like huge opening, you know. I just kind of felt that. It didn't seem like a little thing. Man, for her, it must have been just absolutely huge. Somebody wanted her there.
And in Sangha, we have these forms. Form being an established way of doing something together. You know, it allows us to move together, to know what's coming, to move together harmoniously. And then it becomes pretty obvious when some people can't or won't keep to that form. And what we do about that really defines us as a sangha. You know, it's I don't know. I mean, to some extent, I've seen all kinds of folks that just. I suppose it's true in the real world. We have forms in the real world as well, you know, customs, established ways of doing things, and you can see when somebody's not fitting that. But it's even more obvious because we tend to be just a little more formal and intimate. And there's a way that we can just kind of look away and ignore when somebody's not fitting the form. I mean, we kind of might think it's being polite, but on the other hand, it can be just not seen. So that kind of, you know, response, like she was talking about, where it's, you know, how can we, you know, what can we do so that you can be included? Understanding probably that you're not going to fit into the form quite the way other people do. But there's like that compromise there that. So the person is held, still held. There is a container. It's not just an anything goes, and yet, you know. And it can be, I've been present, witnessed quite a few people over the, you know, my 25 years of Sangha practice. Many of you may have already as well, especially if you've practiced in any other places where, you know, if somebody decides to come and practice in a particular sangha and they have issues like she has, or other issues, sometimes they're just kind of angry and bossy, or they're, you know, whatever. And you just begin to realize over time, everybody has their stuff. Some of us just, you know, we can keep it, we can keep it hidden a little better than other people, but we all have our stuff. And then when we see that somebody like her who really stands out in an obvious way, if they're included, if they're not kicked out, then we're probably safe too. You know, it actually helps the whole scenario. And like, I can tell you, there's been numerous times over this 25 years where I've thought, can't we just encourage that person to leave? You know, they're kind of out there. I mean, I don't think I probably would have felt that way about Beata, because, you know, I probably would have felt some sympathy for her, but there's other kinds of behaviors and ways of being which are a little less sympathetic. And so I've definitely just, you know, maybe somebody who just doesn't seem like they really even give a crap about Buddhism, and they're just kind of here, and you know, they can be disrespectful, or they can be, I don't know, there's all kinds of ways people can be in that sense of like, can't we just, you know, encourage them to move along? And yet the message clearly is always, the only way that you get kicked out of a sangha is if you do not If you egregiously do not keep the precepts, if you really actually are harming others with consideration, you may be asked to leave a sangha. But that leaves a whole lot of latitude for being all different kinds of ways. So I wanted to throw out and ask, in terms of whether within Sangha or in other settings, other places, how have you been held in your limitations? And I think, you know, we can all think of some way we are, something we do, some shortcoming we have that, in a way, I don't know, we're ashamed of, or we just really wish could be different, that if people really knew we were like this, they wouldn't want to accept us. And imagining, you know, like, how have we been, have we had the opportunity to be held by others, to be seen and accepted in some way? Or, you know, have you, to take it out of the intensely personal realm, you know, have you witnessed that happening for others, or tried to hold other people in that way?
I think that happened for me at a term student.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you share so much personal information, and, you know, I just had a lot of fear and shame about all that, and you know, went through that whole process, and it just made me so much more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's just so accepting. And that was actually pretty powerful for me.
That was my experience as well. And for anybody who doesn't know, we have a program that happens once or twice a year, often just once a year, but in the fall. It's a three-month period we call the term, and you sign up as a term student, and there's an opening retreat and an ending retreat, and we all form vows for that period of time, for kind of a cohort for that 3 months. And at that opening retreat, we tell our life stories. So we tell, you know, kind of our karmic life story, basically just the facts, and then kind of what really shaped us, and then our spiritual biography, if you will, and it's usually a pretty, sometimes it's extremely daunting and scary experience for people to have to do that for the first time. It's always a little nerve-wracking, but also can be very, very powerful. And it's not necessarily something that we're ashamed of, you know. I know people who've had, you know, really traumatic experiences in their early, you know, sometime in their life, huge losses, loss of a child or something like that, and, you know, it's just something you just kind of carry and don't talk about, and then when you share it in that setting, and now, you know, the group does not, they don't come over and pat your shoulder and say, it's okay. You wouldn't really want that anyway, you know. But just in holding it, people have heard it, and life goes on, and people have heard it, and we just don't hold one another.
Now 5 years ago, but so it's kind of faded, but In my former job, I've been with a big health system here in the local area for 29 years. Been employed with the last of 19 of those. And then the health system, like so many around the country, decided they had to save a bunch of money, and they eliminated dozens and dozens of positions and eliminated the entire leadership team that I was part of. They saved a lot of money, but the effect on all of the people on my team was really rough. And I went through a process of just realizing how naive I was to think that I was, quote, one of the family, as I was told over and over. And, realized how I was attached to a certain role and identity and preconceptions about what that longevity meant in terms of security. Didn't mean anything. Those kinds of crashing realities. And so I had a little severance period, and then I found this new job with Hazel and Betty Ford, who I've been with for 5 years, and accepted that job. And within the first week, I found myself in an amazing community of compassionate people that, as I told a little bit about that story, the experience of that compassionate holding of my story, just almost, they didn't have to say a lot, but just felt accepted and understood and not judged, was earth-shaking to me compared to where I'd been and the culture I'd been in. To this day, I continue to feel that way about these people in my work community. They're some of the most kind of personally, know a lot of their own personal work, mature, accepting, non-judging, compassionate, loving, kind, outstanding clinicians. So I just feel, like I've been through a really wonderful experience. I feel very grateful. It's life-changing, continues to be. This kind of wonderful gift turned out to be actually kind of a good thing that I lost that job. Turned out to be the alternative was fabulous, life changing. So all the confusion, the hurt, the resentment, the questions, the confusion, they just held that and listened and seemed to understand.
I had an experience at Sesshin in March at Pia Zen Center, and attending this Sesshin was my last requirement for my graduation. And I had 6 months into the program, I had a bad head injury, so I was a year behind. And part of the head injury was that it impacted my ability to practice. And I'd gotten to the point where I could practice and, for several hours, but I was really challenged that this idea of doing a 7-day sesshin, I thought it could likely be too much. And when it would get to be too much, it would be like literally like my brain would just feel like it locked up and stopped working. And only like really sleeping a lot would then kind of reset me. So I had some trepidation, but then I got a note saying, would you like to be an Oryoki server? And I'm like, yeah. It's like if I'm serving, that means 3 times a day, like I'm up and moving and I'm getting up and down. And they're like, it can be strenuous. And I'm like, strenuous, yay, better than sitting. because I, yeah. That was my. And so the first day, like, it was great, but it was really demanding because it's like very ritualized in this very beautiful Japanese style sendo, this very beautiful formal service. You've got these big pots and you gotta like go to the right place and bow at the right time and kneel and serve and not spill and get back up and
you know, remember all the details.
An orioke is a formal meal.
It's a formal Zen meal. Yeah. And every moment is scripted and ritualized, and there's no words in it. And when you're serving and everybody has just been sitting all day, like, the server's really like the orioke show, which is not hard to see, but you just feel like you are very, people are very aware of your presence. So you're trying to, and then the other thing about it is you have to serve fast because people need their break, and nobody gets their break until everybody's done eating. So you've got to serve fast, but you've got to be very mindful and present. Although you're very fast, but not very fast. So it's a whole thing. And then it's at high altitude, 7,000 feet. So the first day, it's all gravy. I'm like, yes, my mind is wandering, but that's the problem you're supposed to have with Zazen. This is like, it's so golden. And then the second day, I started like feeling not very good. And I started having trouble in one of the meals keeping up, and I was trying to be more mindful. And at the end of the service, our head server would like get us in a little huddle and give us feedback of like, doing a good job, remember, do this way with the trays, whatever the thing. And so we went over it, and he's like, this is great, we've taken 10 minutes off our last time. Just literally, he was timing. But then at the very end, he said to me, and he just said, and he said this so kindly, but he said, Kathy, I noticed you looked a little tired today. If it's too much for you, I could have one of the residents serve. And then I was just like, what? I'm the weak link. I'm like the one who's breaking it down. And inside myself, all this stuff is happening, and I just was like, I just kind of froze up. So I just said to him, I am a bit tired. Let me think about that. And then we were going to eat. And then when we were eating, like, my mind was just like, they don't know. I can ride my bike over mountains. I'm so strong. And they might think I look old, but I'm strong. What? I'm old. I'm a weak link. I'm coughing so much. I am so tired. This is making it even harder to sit. And, like, all of this was going around in my mind. And then I just had this just, like, awareness of, like, oh, he just saw you. And he just responded with kindness to what he saw in you. And it turned from being about I failed at serving to being like, yes, at this moment, on this day, at this point in my life, it will be better for me to sit and receive service, and it'll be better for somebody else to serve. And it just changed something in me in a really deep way, in an understanding of the unity of giving and receiving, of helping and needing help, and of that real thing of orioke being the embodiment of our harmony as a community, which is harmony but not identity, like we're not identical. And I shifted with this girl, and afterwards she told me, the other funny thing was the person then who changed with me was sitting behind me, so sometimes she would be sitting looking at my back, and then when we turned, I would be sitting and looking at her back. And I would see her serve, and I'd see the other servers. And I felt so much appreciation for them, and so much it was the way that the head server spoke to me, and the way this was held and the transfer happened, just opened something in my heart that became kinder to myself and to everybody.
Thank you for sharing. And you made the rest of the session
I did, and I also gave, I also ended up realizing that I was being too hard on myself and making myself sit in every sit, and I talked to my teacher and said I need to step out in the afternoon, and I can be silent, but I need to be outside. And I did that, and he's like, yes, we're human beings in human bodies, do it, you know, we're each other, heart, mind, brain, you do what you need. So it was really an experience of learning to be kinder.
I had an experience recently. I was talking with my Dharma sisters about Dharma Rain Zen Center, where I trained, and our teachers, and somehow one of my Dharma sisters and I were kind of, you know how you like, in a really good conversation with a good friend, you kind of can talk your way closer to the truth. You help each other. You're kind of uncovering new territory as you go. And we were realizing how Kyogen Carlson, so not my personal teacher, but the husband of my personal teacher, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, you got both of them when you got one of them. And there was something about him that always had been a source of a little frustration to me, that I don't know, like his senior students, sometimes, I mean, they felt it too, like he didn't really guide them that much. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, what is this even supposed to be about? You know, and then people who became leaders and teachers, I don't know, at times it'd be just like, let's just say, put it gently, that I wished he would have trained them to be other than how they were. You know, that they have some serious shortcomings. They have, you know, just ways that they don't really listen to people, or, you know, this person might have this shortcoming, this person might have a different one, whatever. And I said, it seems like he just kind of let people, you know, he was kind of hands off. He just let people become what they were going to become, and, you know. And then I was seeing how that had happened with these other people, and then I was like, oh, he did that with me too. And suddenly, like, something clicked, and I realized, like, you know, I mean, he and I were often, like, kind of like this, maybe not in overt ways, but I was fairly resistant to many of his way. I always had other suggestions, which may or may not be taken, and so there was a sense like, huh, he really held the space for me too, and in some ways, you might even say, kind of protected us from each other's criticisms and judgments. Because if, you know, if he thought you were doing okay, like, well, you know, Richard can't complain, right? So he kind of protected all of the individual quirky people to become who we were meant to become. And like, wow, I didn't even notice it. It was a kindness that, I guess it would have been unkind if he had said, I'm just tolerating you. and keeping my fingers crossed. You know.
But you kind of alluded in the end of that chapter, finding your own way. Mm-hmm. And it's the wisdom to allow somebody to find their own way is difficult.
Yeah.
Because we think we know the right way.
Yeah. And there's also a, I don't know, like, I think, at times, I think over my 25 years, I felt a little bit stingy about making allowances for other people. Not if, again, if they were kind of, if somebody's obviously suffering physically or emotionally or something, like, you know, that's, I don't know about you, but I find that relatively easy to make space for. But if somebody's just kind of obnoxious or oblivious or resistant or whatever, that's a little more like, eh. And I remember this one guy who would just, he would just, he was so loud. Everything he did was, he just stomped. It wasn't a concrete floor like this. It was like a second floor. He would just, boom, boom, you know, just knew who was walking. And it was just like, you know, aren't we supposed to be moving with, like, mindfulness and carefulness? And but, you know, this guy could just stomp around like a gorilla. And I, one day, I was just kind of fed up on one of those days of session, and now everybody had gone downstairs for the meal, and I was on my way, and I just kind of stomped across the sendo floor. And then I got down the stairs, and my teacher was at the bottom of the stairs, and she said, "Stop." And it was just kind of like, that's not fair. Like, why did he stop? And I don't get to stop. But in a way, it's like, yeah, but if we're strong enough to do it, if we're strong enough to keep the form, then, you know, and then when we need the allowances, we can ask for them and be given them. All right, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.